Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 16th, Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Douglas County, It's a Political Prize by Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. World War II Japanese American Internment Camp, Senate Votes to Protect Amachi by Bruce Finley, the Denver Post. Firestone, Drilling Plan, A Test of New Setback Rules by Judith Kohler, the Denver Post. Douglas County, It's a Political Prize. School Boards Have a History of High-Profile Education Battles by Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. Local school boards have become more partisan recently amid national debates about COVID-19 and how teachers ought to teach about racism. But in Douglas County School District, tense high-profile battles between educators, administrators, and parents have a longer history. The district, which recently saw two protests involving hundreds of teachers and students, allegations of violating state open meeting laws, and the firing of its superintendent, all in a span of 8 days, has faced highly divisive clashes since reformers took control in 2009. Douglas County School District was on the leading edge of school board elections becoming pretty politicized, says Paul Teske, Dean of the School of Public Affairs at the University of Colorado, Denver. The county has become a barometer for national politicians on how wealthy suburban Republicans are leaning on different issues, he said. It's a political prize for donors who would like to see a more radical set of policies come out of the school board, added Kevin Wellner, director of the University of Colorado's National Education Policy Center in Boulder, noting that the Douglas County School Board is a large school district in an affluent and largely conservative community. The district's Board of Education made national headlines during the pandemic for its heated debates and for the money that flowed in during last year's election. Since the election, the board's four conservative members who hold the majority have moved quickly to lift mask requirements for schools and ask for possible changes to the district's equity policy. The four clashed with other three members of the board in a meeting 2 weeks ago when they voted to fire Superintendent Corey Wise. His termination came days after three minority members alleged the board's president and vice president, Mike Peterson and Christy Williams, privately told Wise to resign or be voted out and violated Colorado's open meeting laws in the process. Williams said during the February 4th school board meeting that they did not violate sunshine laws. The allegations spurred about 1,000 teachers, staffers, and other community members to protest outside district offices in Castle Rock on February 3rd. 3 days later, hundreds of students from at least eight schools walked out of their classrooms. The fact that the school board attracts so much interest and action from parents, students, and the broader community is not surprising, according to former teachers and an ex-school board member who worked in the district when it garnered national attention for its school reform policies in the 2010s. "We were a unicorn back then," said Tracy Mum, a former English journalism and speech teacher who left the district in 2013. "No other school district could believe what was happening to us." School board candidates typically run without party affiliation in elections that are often overlooked and don't attract large pocketed donors. And boards are generally expected to do their best to insulate schools from culture wars that may be taking place at the time, Wellner, the national education policy expert, said. But that has not always been the case in Douglas County School District. Even back in 2009, when national school board antics were known to be boring, Douglas County was locked in a partisan battle when the Republican Party backed four candidates for the board, a decision that at the time was attributed to the teachers' union's involvement in the race. The Douglas County School Board 2 years later voted for a voucher program to give taxpayer money to help pay for students to go to private schools. The initiative, which was never implemented because of legal disputes, stood out because of high-performing suburban school district Douglas County was an unusual candidate for such a program. Republicans' interest in the school board did not wane, and in 2013, in what was then called a fractious race, the Colorado chapter of the Americans for Prosperity, the group founded by the late David Cook, ran television ads to support candidates. By then, conservatives across the U.S. saw Douglas County as a model for transforming public schools everywhere, Politico wrote at the time. Back then, the debate about school board policies was not as clearly split between party lines, and at least nationally, there were members of both the right and the left who supported school choice, even if it was for different reasons, said Megan Silverthorne, who was elected to the board in 2009 and supported the district's reforms. Boulder County's affluent and mostly conservative residents care strongly about their community, and they have the means to advocate for what they want and expect out of their child's education, she said. And what has developed, she said, is a tug of war between parents and teachers over what happens in classrooms. Nationally, parents are concerned their children are falling behind in things like reading, writing, and math, especially as the pandemic has disrupted in-person classes for the past 2 years. But these discussions are even more contentious in Douglas County School District because of the school board's long history, Silverthorne said. Parents are saying, wait a minute, that's not what I said, she said, adding, teachers are the linchpin in the school district. Beyond the voucher program, the school board during that period made other changes, including paying teachers via a market-based system and shunning the teachers' union. The change in pay, which was implemented in 2012, replaced the traditional salary scale that was based on educator tenure and education level with one that used performance evaluations and set salaries based on how difficult different positions were to fill. Teachers who worked during that time described it as a period of low morale and high turnover. The school board's changes added to teachers' workload in ways that didn't always seem to benefit students. And with the union sidelined, many felt that they had lost their voice, according to former teachers. I felt powerless, Mum said. Suddenly, I felt like the enemy. Members of the community used to request teachers' emails under the state's public records law to see if we were talking with the union, she said, adding, it became very contentious very quickly. Many teachers left the district, some taking significant pay cuts when they changed schools. Silverthorne, the former school board member, acknowledged the teacher and staff exodus the district experienced. It's pretty easy to blame teacher turnover on a change like that, she said. Teachers left for a number of reasons. I'm not going to pretend that some of the things we put in weren't the reason that they left. Former Douglas County school district teachers said they fear that the firing of Wise will spur more educators to leave the district once again. A lot of people I know will retire if they can afford to, said Kamala Schuster, who taught in the district for 21 years before leaving in 2015. People are going to jump ship as fast as they can. With the research for a new superintendent soon underway, Douglas County School District is going to need a strong leader to reassure teachers that their interests are going to be looked after and that they are valued as professionals, Silverthorne said. The school board is holding a meeting at 5 p.m. on Wednesday to discuss its timeline for hiring a new superintendent. One high-profile departure is already in process. Sid Rundle, Special Education Services Officer for the district, will leave on February 18th. Rundle, who declined to comment for the story, blamed the board's decision to fire Wise for his leaving the district in his resignation letter, which was obtained via a public records request. Rundle submitted the letter on February 5th, a day after Wise was fired without cause. Despite their propaganda, the board does not value loyalty, hard work, dedication, relationships, decency, humility, or integrity, he wrote. Instead, they showed themselves to be firmly yoked to political influence, arrogant ideology, and a disdain for due process. Douglas County School Board isn't the only one to face partisan politics. In 2014, a member of the school board overseeing Jeffco Public Schools proposed changing the curriculum so that it presented the positive aspects of the nation's history and did not encourage or condone civil disorder, social strife, or disregard of the law. That same year, Superintendent Cynthia Stevenson left the district earlier than expected. "I didn't want to be pushed out," Stevenson said. "I could deal with that. My deal was I'd rather walk out and sustain my pride. As a leader of an organization, you can't let yourself be treated badly." The reason for the current conflict permeating through Douglas County School District is different than what happened in the mid-2010s. Now it is facing many districts where disputes over masks, library books, and critical race theory, which examines how racism is embedded in the American legal system and other institutions, are taking place. I don't think Douglas County is anything but a microcosm of what you are seeing elsewhere, said Stu Parker, Douglas County's Republican Party chairman. We've been at it longer, but I don't think it's that any different. World War II Japanese-American internment camp. Senate votes to protect Amachi, by Bruce Finley. Move makes area eligible for increased preservation funds, the Denver Post. U.S. senators have cleared the way for Amachi, the former World War II Japanese-American internment camp in rural southeastern Colorado, to become a federal historic site managed by the National Park Service. Senators unanimously approved the Amachi National Historic Site Act to make the camp's ruins days before the 80th anniversary of the U.S. government's forced internment of 120,000 Japanese Americans during the war, eligible for increased preservation funds. Colorado lawmakers, led by Senator Michael Bennett, pushed through this legislation, co-sponsored by Senator John Hickenlooper. Senator Mike Lee, Republican Utah, had been the lone holdout opposing federal acquisition of any land without an offset until Bennett brokered a deal late Monday. The push began with House legislation introduced by Reps Joe Neguse, Democrat Lafayette, and Ken Buck, Republican of Windsor, which passed the House in July on a 416-2 vote. A majority of House lawmakers still must sign off on the Senate amendment added to secure Lee's vote. The current owner of the 480-acre site, the town of Granada, will donate the land to the National Park Service. This action means Amachi Camp survivors, including Ken Kitajima, 91, have had their stories presented more widely and interpreted for large numbers of visitors. Kitajima was a teenager confined to the Amachi camp from 1943 until 1945. He remembers the barbed wire fencing, guard towers, military men with machine guns, and searchlights. When Japanese warlords bombed Pearl Harbor, school classmates in Campbell, California, chased Kitajima and his sister, throwing rocks, forcing them to walk home instead of riding a bus. "When the government gave us 2 weeks to leave with only what you can carry, I was kind of glad we were leaving because we didn't have to go to school and get chased home by boys throwing rocks at us. But it was a terrible experience," Kitajima said. "We were citizens, most of us. We lost everything. It was a mass hysteria when Japan dropped the bombs on Pearl Harbor. It magnified the racist attitudes. A lot of people didn't like Japanese. We were told to move out, and we were called all kinds of names. It was racially oriented." The Democratic President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the executive order. When he signed it, that is the day I call the true day of infamy. Bennett called the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II a shameful part of our country's history, and said this act will preserve Amachi's history to ensure future generations can learn from this dark chapter in our history. Ruins of food halls, military police stations, a cemetery, and barracks can be found at the site, which has been maintained since 1993 by Granada High School history teacher and Dean John Hopper and scores of his students. The town of Granada owns the site, which is already listed on the National Register of Historic Places. This is going to take some of the pressure off us, Hopper said. He and his students began by mowing weeds in the Amachi Cemetery. Eventually, they opened a museum. Japanese Americans supported the effort. Hopper and his students, who met with lawmakers, still plan to manage their museum exhibit, which features new research and has expanded into larger buildings in Granada. This story needs to be told, so we won't repeat a wrong, Hopper said. Hopefully, preserving sites like this will teach the youth, our future leaders, that it's wrong. The order by Roosevelt on February 19, 1942, forced 120,000 Japanese Americans to leave their homes in the western United States. The U.S. government imprisoned them at 10 camps in California, Arizona, Wyoming, Utah, Arkansas, and Colorado. More than 7,000 were held between 1942 and 1945 at Amachi, which is named after a Cheyenne chief's daughter. Firestone, drilling plan a test of new setback rules, by Judith Kohler, the Denver Post. A proposal by a subsidiary of Occidental Petroleum to drill 33 wells near a neighborhood in Firestone is shaping up to test new oil and gas rules that were touted as among the strongest in the country. The wells that Kerr McGee wants to drill in southwestern Weld County are fewer than 2,000 feet from 87 homes. Rules approved in late 2020 as part of the overhaul of state oil and gas regulations required that wells be set back at least 2,000 feet from homes and schools, with some exceptions. One of the exceptions allowed in the rules is a finding by the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission that a company's plan provides protections that are substantially equivalent to a 2,000-foot setback. COGCC Director Julie Murphy said in a February 2nd document that Kerr McGee's application complies with the rules, but didn't recommend whether the commission should approve the plan. The five-member commission was scheduled to consider the application in a public hearing Wednesday. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment said in a letter to COGCC that it should deny the application unless Kerr McGee agrees to 13 steps to minimize the potential health and environmental impact of the wells. The steps include air quality monitoring, equipment to capture emissions, procedures to minimize noise and odors, and using electric drill rigs to reduce emissions. The COGCC staff agreed with Kerr McGee that some of the recommendations from the health department aren't feasible, such as using an electric drilling rig rather than one fueled by natural gas. The COGCC has previously approved one application that will allow wells within 2,000 feet of homes after the landowners gave their consent, one of the carve-outs permitted under the regulation. Andrew Forks Gunmason, with the community group League of Oil and Gas Impacted Coloradans, called the findings by the COGCC staff wildly frustrating and confusing. The group, represented by Earth Justice, an environmental law firm, opposes the two well pads Kerr McGee wants to develop. The application is exactly what Senate Bill 181 was passed to prevent, Forks Gudmundsen said. The bill passed by the legislature in 2019 mandated revamping state rules to prioritize public health, safety, and the environment when regulating oil and gas. Before that, the COGCC was tasked with balancing mineral development with protecting public health and the environment. This is a residential drilling all over again. This is a massive mega pad with 26 wells on it, plus another with 7 more wells on it, within 2,000 feet of 87 homes and hundreds of people, Forks Gudmundsen said. There are thousands of homes within a mile. The 33-well pad called McGavin would be 763 feet apart from the closest home, according to COGCC director's report. I don't know how they can, on one hand, say that the COGCC has the most protective regulations in the country, and on the other hand, not deny this, Forks Gudmundsen said. Bill Coffey and his wife moved in September 2021 to the Falcon Point at Saddleback Subdivision in Firestone. He estimates that his home is a little more than 2,000 feet from the proposed 26-well McGavin pad, but is still concerned the noise, truck traffic, and emissions from the equipment and oil and gas productions will be problems. Technically, we would be outside the zone that was set up by Senate Bill 181, but things that go into the air don't know a border, Coffey said. His wife is immunocompromised, Coffey added, and he worries about air pollution and emissions of fracking fluids, which can include such cancer-causing substances as benzene. The Firestone Board of Trustees approved the locations of the two well pads in January. Under an agreement between the town and Kerr McGee, the company will give Firestone a 78-acre tract of undeveloped land. Proponents of the 2,000-foot setbacks pointed to a 2019 report from the state health department that outlined certain short-term health impacts for people living within 2,000 feet of fracking sites. Industry representatives opposed the setbacks, saying they would hinder oil and gas development and that Colorado voters previously rejected a ballot measure requiring 2,500-foot buffers. When approved, the 2,000-foot setbacks were described as among the toughest in the nation. But at the time, Joe Salazar, an attorney with the environmental group Colorado Rising, said the exceptions to the rule amounted to loopholes for the oil and gas industry. I had indicated pretty early on that I believed abuses could happen through this rulemaking, through these exceptions, these variances, Salazar said. The COGCC staff said Kerr McGee held a community meeting in July 2020 and a virtual meeting in August 2021 to discuss its plans. Other outreach include mailings, phone calls, and visits to homes. The company submitted several letters of support to the COGCC. During the public comment period from October 1st to the 31st last year, the COGCC received 20 comments on the proposal. Some were opposed to oil and gas operations in Firestone. Forks Gudmundsen said several residents in his organization didn't know they could file protests or believed it was a done deal. He contended that Kerr McGee hasn't sufficiently proved that its proposed technology and procedures will provide the same protection that drilling further away would. The COGCC cited the company's plan to automate some of the work, use pipelines to deliver water rather than trucks to the site, and use noise reduction equipment on its drilling rigs as some of the most stringent best management practices in Colorado. However, Forks Gudmundsen said he wants to see more evidence, including computer modeling of the site's emissions, to show Kerr McGee's proposed operations would adequately protect area residents. It would be a lot of work. I'm not trying to sugarcoat it, Forks Gudmundsen said, but these are impactful decisions. These locations, if they get approved, are going to be in people's backyards for decades. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Mary Sue Dunn Boucher, May 19, 1936 to February 11, 2022. For full obituary and service information, please visit HoranCares.com. Cletus Bud Byrne Jr., 1930 to 2022. A St. Louis boy born and bred, Bud graduated from McBride High School. After serving in the U.S. Army during the Korean conflict, Bud returned to St. Louis, where he graduated from St. Louis University with a degree in accounting and began a 51-year career in the investment business. In 1962, he was transferred to Denver and fell in love with Colorado. He had a distinguished career, including service to the Board of Governors of the National Association of Security Dealers and as an NASD arbitrator for 30 years. He also served on the Lay Advisory Board of St. Mary's Academy for 16 years. After retiring, Bud pursued his passions for travel and spending time with family and friends. He was preceded in death by his first wife, Nancy Nangle Byrne, second wife, Leah Schelzel, and third wife, Kay Chorley Grossman Byrne. His parents, Cletus Sr. and Mary Bess Byrne, brother Donald Byrne, wife Loretta, sister Audrey Merkel, husband George, and brother-in-law Charles Schwinderman. He is survived by sister Elizabeth Betty Schwinderman, daughters Elizabeth Byrne, husband Robert, and Barb Waffle, husband Steve, grandson Drew Waffle, wife Julia, granddaughter Ann Clinton, great-grandson Declan Waffle, and many stepchildren and step-grandchildren, sisters and brothers-in-law, and nieces and nephews. Bud was a quintessential people person, known for his joy de vivre and lively sense of humor. He was also ready with a story or a one-liner. Despite the untimely death of his first wife, Nancy, he went on to find love with Leah, and after her passing, once again with Kay. Though he faced numerous health challenges in his last years, he never lost his optimism or his thoughtful and generous spirit. He will be deeply missed to all who had the pleasure of knowing him. A special thanks to Lisa Lowe for her steadfast love and friendship, and to his wonderful caregivers. Donations in Bud's memory may be made to St. Mary's Academy, 4545 South University Boulevard, Inglewood, Colorado, 80122. www.stmarys.academy/donate. Arupe Jesuit High School, 4343 Utica Street, Denver, Colorado, 80212. www.arupejesuit.com/give. A celebration of his life will take place in Denver, Friday, February 25th. Funeral mass and interment in St. Louis, Missouri, Saturday, February 26, 2022, 10 a.m., the Old Cathedral. Louise Johanna Cavanis, July 20, 1931 to January 1, 2022. Louise Johanna Hartman Cavanis, January 20th, 1931 to January 1st, 2022, passed away on January 1st, 2022 at the age of 90 with her children by her side. Lois's greatest legacies she modeled for her children were integrity, hard work, and love of learning, books, and travel. Born in Spokane, Washington on July 20th, 1931, Lois was an early reader and also taught herself to play piano by ear. Lois grew up in eastern Washington town of Fairfield, Washington. As a youth, she traveled the eastern Washington area playing duets at a wide variety of functions. From a very early age, Miss Hartmeyer rode her horses in the annual Fairfield Flag Day Parade and then eventually helped train and show horses in and around Washington, Oregon, and Northern California. Valedictorian of Fairfield High School class of 1949 and a daughter of the American Revolution winner, Lois went to the honors program at Washington State College, graduating summa cum laude in 1953 to become a high school English teacher. Her first teaching job was in the logging town of Newport, Washington. It was there she met World War II Navy veteran Robert Cavanis, who was teaching and coaching at Newport High School. Bob proposed on their third date. They were married on August 1st of 1954. They were married for 54 years at the time of Bob's passing in 2009. The couple moved to Colorado in 1956 in order for Lois, Jo to begin her master's degree in library services at DU Women's College. Their stay in Colorado was to be temporary, but they found happiness, friends, success, and developed a love of the varied landscape of Colorado. Lois also developed a love of Southwestern Native American art and gardening in Colorado. Lois Jo initially started teaching at the Denver Public Schools at Smiley Junior High and eventually moved to Aurora Public Schools. She taught English in North Junior High School for several years before their children were born. She returned to work as the librarian at Gateway High School for 17 years and presented on library topics at several regional and national conferences. Lois was also a very active member of the Alpha Delta Kappa, aka, for women's educators for many years. Lois Kavanis retired from 32 years of teaching and became a librarian in 1991. Lois's love affair with Chihuahuas began in the 1950s after Bob bought her a puppy as a present. Robert and Lois were members of several AKC breeders associations in Colorado. Lois showed many Chihuahuas over the years. Kavanis Chihuahuas were known throughout the USA and the American Kennel Club for their excellent conformation and outgoing temperament. Lois has had two number one puppies in the nation and had several nationally ranked Chihuahuas. In all, Lois finished 48 champion Chihuahuas, the majority of them owner bred and handled. After retiring from showing dogs, Lois and Bob became avid birders who traveled to several states to enjoy the natural beauty in birds. Lois also enjoyed traveling to Europe and South America with family and friends. Lois was preceded in death by her parents, Henry Joseph Hartmeyer and Crystal Frances Severina Sorensen Hartmeyer, her sister Barbara Hartmeyer Browning, and her beloved husband Robert Franklin Kavanis. She is survived by her children, Craig Kavanis, wife Vicky, Marla Kavanis French, husband Rob, and six beloved grandchildren, Ryan, Caitlin, Aaron, RJ, Zach, and Hannah, who inherited Lois's love of learning, books, and travel. A celebration of life will take place Sunday, March 6, 2022 at 12 p.m. at Stonebrook Manor in Thornton, Colorado. In lieu of flowers, the family asks that you make a donation to your favorite high school library to help keep the love of books and learning going strong in high schools, and or an animal shelter to help care for animals in need, and or the Fairfield Flag Day at Fairfield Service Club, P.O. Box 198, Fairfield, Washington 99012, attention Fairfield Flag Day. Thank you to the caregivers of Visiting Angels Aurora, Bayada Home Healthcare, Seasons Hospice, and Bonaventure Senior Living of Thornton for their care of Lois. Huge thank you to Janet Howell for her excellent care and friendship with Lois and kind guidance over the last several years. Thoughts and memories can be sent to 2022loisc@gmail.com. If you are planning on attending Lois's celebration of life on March 6, 2022 at 12 p.m., an RSVP would be greatly appreciated due to the ongoing concerns around coronavirus. Her family would like to make sure that the room is set up for the appropriate social distancing. Please email RSVPs to 2022loisc@gmail.com. or RSVP Lois Kavanis Celebration of Life Google Form. Larry J. Floriancic, January 2nd, 1939 to January 30th, 2022. Larry Floriancic passed away on January 30th, 2022. Service to be held February 22nd at 1:30 p.m. at Crown Hill Mortuary. Please visit crownhillmortuary.com for service details and full obituary. Jerome J. Jerry Foss, January 3rd, 1941 to February 11th, 2022. Jerome J. Jerry Foss Jr. passed away on February 11, 2022. For service information and life story, please see HoranCares.com. Kenneth E. Grubenhoff, November 6, 1937 to January 17, 2022. Ken Grubenhoff died at home on January 17, 2022. Born in Toppenish, Washington, Ken was the fifth of seven children born to Catherine Bernice Schnellenbach, whose family homesteaded near Wild Horse, Colorado, and Erwin Frank Grubenhoff. He was preceded in death by his siblings, Dick, wife Betty, Lori, McDonald, husband Jack, Harold, wife Bev, sister-in-law Carmen, and brother-in-law Ray Wedden. He is survived by his siblings Don and twins born on his eighth birthday, Diana Wedden and Dennis, husband Kathy, and also his wife of 53 years, Marty. There are two sons, Joe, husband Cindy, and John, wife Mary Beth, and three grandchildren, Jesse, Caleb, and Asher. After teaching Spanish language and literature at DU for 5 years, Ken turned his hobby of buying and selling antiques into a career and opened his shop, Glass Roots, which he ran successfully for 25 years. Ken was known for his kindness, honesty, humility, extraordinary knowledge of history and geography, and love of his family and friends. He had an incredibly full life and will be missed. Full obituary with service details at HoranCares.com. Rita Hart, March 26, 1922 to December 27, 2021. Rita Hart, 99 of Inglewood, Colorado, passed away peacefully at home. Rita was born in New York City to Ann Sobel at the end of World War II. She met and married Merrill A. Hart, who had just completed his tour of duty with the U.S. Navy in the Pacific Theater. Together, they had four sons, Carrie, Rennie, Jody, and Lonnie. Rita spent the majority of her life in the Denver area and was an expert nutritionist. She worked for natural grocers until she was 98, having been close friends with the natural grocers' founders, Margaret and Philip Isley, from the time they started the retail health food business in 1955. In addition to her passion for sharing her knowledge and example about good health through diet, Rita was an avid reader and a talented writer, primarily using the talent to serve others by reviewing, proofreading, and making editing suggestions for those seeking to publish. Above all, she was a devoted mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, putting the welfare and family love above all else. Rita was preceded in death by her mother, Ann Sobel, and her brother, Murray Sobel. She is survived by her four sons, Carrie Hart, Rennie Hart, Jody Hart, and Lonnie Hart, by five grandchildren, Christopher Hart, Stephanie Hart, Aaron Hart, Brooke Hart, and Dustin Hart, and also by 11 great-grandchildren. There will not be a service as Rita, thinking about serving humanity to the end, donated her body to science. However, a memorial to celebrate her life is pending. George Kochaniak, November 5th, 1955 to January 24th, 2022. Pulitzer Prize winner George Stephen Kochaniak Jr., age 66, of Harrison, passed away at his home on January 24th, 2022. George was born November 5th, 1955 in Macomb, Michigan, the son of George Gregory Kochaniak and Elaine Loretta Kotsitz Kochaniak. George had resided in Harrison since 2020, moving from Tallahassee, Florida. George was a fearless Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist who masterfully captured breaking news, action, and the human condition. He was an avid outdoorsman, enjoying both hunting and fishing. No matter where he lived, he always made loyal friends. Surviving Mr. Kochaniak is his son, Stephen, and wife, Chrissy, of Gig Harbor, Washington, two grandchildren, Liam and Lily, one brother, Daryl, and wife, Kate, of Orlando, Florida, many loving nieces, nephews, and extended family members. Mr. Kochanicek is preceded in death by his parents, one son, Bradley, and one brother, Dave. Life celebration services honoring George will be held in Tallahassee, Florida, and Denver, Colorado. Interment will be at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church, 624 Miccosukee Road, Tallahassee, Florida, 32308. To share an online memory of or condolence of George's family, please visit his Facebook page. Maurice Butch Lutwak, July 29, 1939 to February 14, 2022. A visitation will be held on February 18, 2022 from 10 a.m. to 10:50 a.m., followed by a funeral mass at 11 a.m. at Spirit of Christ Catholic Community, 7400 West 80th Avenue, Arvada. For full obituary, see HoranCares.com. Rudy Martinez, November 27, 1932 to January 22, 2022. Rudy L. Martinez, retired barber, owner of Downtown Barbers, husband of the late Rebecca Bonsell, services February 18th, 11:30 a.m., Mount Olivet. For full obit, please see cfcscolorado.org. Amanda Oakes. Amanda Jean Oakes of Lakewood, Colorado, passed away on February 11, 2022 at the age of 41. Loving daughter, sister, aunt, and friend. Please visit HoranCares.com for full obituary and to leave memories and condolences for her family. Martha Ann Howland Rowe. Martha Ann Howland Rowe died peacefully in her sleep from cancer on February 6, 2022 at the age of 87. Born in 1935 in Scott City, Kansas, Martha was the oldest child of five and was raised by her parents, Theodore and Mabel Howland. She was valedictorian of her graduating class at Rocky Ford High School and matriculated to the University of Colorado at Boulder, where she earned a degree in microbiology. She met Garland Rowe at CU and accepted his proposal of marriage when he was serving in the U.S. Navy in the Pacific. They married in 1957 in California and later settled in Denver, Colorado. Known as Marty to her friends and colleagues, she directed the microbiology laboratory at Children's Hospital in Denver and provided essential scientific and management support to the hospital's nationally renowned research in pediatric microbiology/virology. She was certified as a medical technologist and microbiology specialist by the American Society of Clinical Pathologists, and she was a member of the American Society of Microbiology. Marty co-authored 27 publications and taught pediatric microbiology courses throughout the United States. The Rowes were early members of the Welshire Presbyterian Church in Denver, and Marty served as a deacon, an elder, and a mission committee member. She was especially impactful as a liaison between Welshire and Schmidt Elementary School. When Garland suffered a significant spinal cord injury, Marty took over his care and used her microbiology know-how and her love to care for him for decades in their home. She was preceded in death by her parents, her brother Warren, her sister Carol, and her son Curtis. She is survived by her husband Garland, her daughter Rachel, her son-in-law Robert, and her grandchildren Heather, her sister Judy, her brother Maurice, her sister-in-law Mary Ann, and many devoted relatives and close friends from Children's Hospital, Welshire Presbyterian Church, Gaylord Street, Rocky Ford, and all other places she took the opportunity to make friends. She will be remembered as a cheerful, positive, reliable, and sincere person, as well as a wonderful cook. A memorial service will be held at Welshire Presbyterian Church on February 19th. In lieu of flowers, a memorial gift may be made online to wpcdenver.org/giving or mailed to Welshire Presbyterian Church, directed to the Mission Committee at 2999 South Colorado, Denver, Colorado 80222. The family gratefully acknowledges the health care Marty received these past few months from the professional staff at Porter Hospital, Claremont Park, and Namaste Hospice. Deborah Ross Weselow, born Deborah K. White, passed away February 13, 2022. Full obituary and service information at HoranCares.com. Martha Lee Sugg, January 13, 1928 to January 23, 2022. Memorial service on February 20th at 1 p.m. at Daryl Howe Mortuary. Masks required. Visit www.darylhowemortuary.com to watch the live stream. Linda Weitzel, February 26, 1948 to February 8, 2022. Linda Hessler Weitzel passed away on February 11, 2022 after enduring numerous health battles. Her life succumbed to its wear and tear and cancer. Linda grew up on a farm in Hay Springs, Nebraska. Linda is survived by her husband, Dennis, son, Scott, wife, Diane, grandson, Hunter, and her siblings, Steve, wife, Beth Hessler, Mike, wife, Ginger Hessler, Debbie, husband, Mark McCall, and their families, along with their nieces, nephews, and cousins. Linda was preceded in death by her parents, Alex Hessler Jr., Joanne Reeder, and son Chad. A gathering of family and friends will be held on Sunday, February 20th, 2022, from noon to 3 p.m. at the Thornton Active Adult Center, 11181 Colorado Boulevard, Thornton, Colorado. This is a casual event. For full obituary, see HoranCares.com. Shirley Marie Williams, February 6, 1928 to February 4, 2022. Shirley Marie Weigand Williams, February 18, 2022, 2 p.m. memorial service, committal service, 3 p.m., reception 3 to 5 p.m. at Olinger Chapel. For full obituary, go to dignitymemorial.com. And I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. Fall semester. CU Boulder students to see slight decrease in tuition by Annie Mell, the Daily Camera. University of Colorado Boulder students will see a slight tuition decrease this fall due to the elimination of a capital construction fee that was removed from the university's budget last fall. On Friday, CU's Board of Regents were updated on the enrollment rates and projected budgets for each of the system's four campuses. In June, the board approved a $500 tuition increase for incoming Boulder students starting in 2022. That rate will decrease to $300 after the board last fall approved eliminating a capital construction fee that was tied to a bond payment for campus updates. Boulder students will see a $200 decrease in tuition and mandatory fees thanks to the fee being discontinued. Tuition for incoming students in 2023 will revert to the already approved $500 increase and will increase again by another $500 in 2024. CU officials proposed a 3% tuition increase for graduate students and incoming non-resident students on Friday. We have received regular increases in tuition to be able to reflect ongoing costs, O'Rourke said following Friday's meeting. We have these core minimum costs and other things that are going up each year. Regent Sue Sharkey said it's pretty remarkable that CU is able to keep the increase down to 3% considering the soaring inflation rates in the United States. I think it really does not need to be highlighted that in this time of great inflation, the university is still working very, very hard at keeping tuition rates as low as we possibly can, she said. The proposal to increase tuition by 3% was not voted on during Friday's meeting. During the presentation Friday, CU officials also discussed three different scenarios for the 2022-23 CU Boulder budget that have been proposed depending on the amount of funding the state allocates to the university. The scenarios range from an increase of about $47 million to $54 million from last year's budget. The legislature has signaled that they're open to providing more state funding above and beyond what was in the governor's request, and within that, there's a framework to say that the more state funding that is invested into higher education results in low tuition rate increase, Chad Martirano, acting chief financial officer for CU, said. Martirano said Scenario B, which proposes an additional $48.14 million to the budget, and Scenario C, which proposes an additional $54.12 million to the budget, are both in line with the range of what it expects to receive from Colorado lawmakers. The legislature is expected to take action on higher education funding sometimes in March, he said. The Boulder campus is also expected to see enrollment increase by 0.6% this fall, which will add extra cushion to the budget. The extra funding will help cover increasing operating costs and will also help pay for programs and initiatives, some of which includes the university's diversity, inclusion, equity, and access work and maintenance and technology infrastructure. Mother, son, okay after avalanche on Loveland Pass. A mother and son are okay after a Sunday avalanche on Loveland Pass threatened the backcountry skiers. Summit County Rescue Group said it received a call for a buried skier on the pass and responded with the Summit County Sheriff's Office, a Colorado Rapid Avalanche Deployment Team, Arapahoe Basin Ski Patrol, and Flight for Life Colorado. But before the groups got there, the skiers were able to get out on their own. The two were trying to retrieve a piece of rappel gear that they had left behind the day before when they rappelled to ski a chute locally known as Butt Crack, according to SCRG. The son was cutting across a steep slope at the top of the chute when he triggered an avalanche just below the ridge. The man was taken 200 to 300 feet down the mountain in avalanche debris, falling an estimated 50 feet off a cliff, SCRG said. The mother stayed safe and was not caught, allowing her to reach her son in about 10 minutes and help him get unburied out of waist-deep snow. SCRG says that the son suffered some minor injuries. It is incredible that the skier caught was able to walk away from this accident, SCRG wrote on Facebook. Although avalanche danger has been relatively low lately, there is still danger, and it's important not to get complacent. Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head.